Welcome to the Evoking History Podcast.
We are called as a people to give testimony in the sight of the world to our faith that the future shall belong to the free. Since this century's beginning, a time of tempest has seemed to come upon the continents of the earth. Masses of Asia have awakened to strike off shackles of the past. Great nations of Europe have fought their bloodiest wars. Thrones have toppled, and their vast empires have disappeared. New nations have been born. For our own country, it has been a time of recurring trial. We have grown in power and in responsibility.
And welcome back to the Evoking History Podcast. With me this week again is Michael Carter, who is an adjunct professor in the Genocide Studies program at Keene University and has been a guest on the program before. How are you doing today, Michael?
I am doing very well. I am, you know, like I said before we started recording, as far as, you know, apocalypses go, I'm doing fairly well.
Yeah, I mean, I saw it floating around Twitter, and I will parrot it here. I wish I could give attribution to who first tweeted it, but I don't remember. But REM assured me that I'd be feeling much better at this point.
Yeah, and it's especially when you're staring down the pipe and you have no idea what September looks like, let alone December and February, and you know, in academia everything's planned a year in advance, but you can't look forward 3 months. So.
Well, I mean that. Actually, I'm going to call an audible because we had kind of what we were going to open with talking about, but that makes me want to change it. And I've gotten so used to talking about everybody, about the impact of the pandemic, that I forget that me and you really haven't talked about it in this format.
No. The really funny thing is, I'll tell this story briefly. Right before the pandemic started, well, I guess the pandemic might have technically started in January, but until we all started noticing, so let's say like early March, late February, I started putting together a new research project, kind of a successor to one I've been talking about for a while, which is the Conestoga story. I think I might have talked about it last time I met a Donna friend. But I realized that mixed into that, actually late, unrelated but kind of related because history is complicated, there's this story of this guy named Frederick Stump, who got this title of an Indian killer, and you can track him down from like Pennsylvania to Georgia to Tennessee, and he's kind of a, I'm still doing the research and sort of figuring out where all the parts come together, but he seems to be a good example of, you take one guy who has this obvious, let's say, genocidal fascination with his killing indigenous people. That might be a bit hyperbolic, but I'll stick with that for now, and sort of trace him through, you know, before the revolution, the revolutionary period, and post-revolution, as far as like early America. And it's a really interesting concept. So I sat down and I talked to, you know, people I know, and I started setting up this big long list of archives to go to, and I am still sitting on that list, almost angrily, as I stare at all the places that I could be to in 20 minutes that just aren't open. One of the highlights of that research was actually the day during spring break where I went to a meeting to discuss how we were going. This is obviously last semester. Sat in on a meeting to discuss how we were going to transition to online. I left that meeting, which was, and drove immediately to Philadelphia to fit in one day at the Historical Society Archives before it all shut down. And I got about maybe 2 hours worth of work before I'm like, I gotta get out of here. So it's rough. It's rough for everybody. And I mean, online archives are great. Online resources are great. You know, I think some of them have closed, but I know a lot of the databases have opened up in some capacity, or at least they were opened up in some capacity. So there are avenues to take, but it's rough when you're sitting on like, oh, I need this text from this library and this university, and that campus isn't only closed, but it's a special collection, so you're not getting that for the next 6 months. It's, you know.
Yeah, it has dramatically changed the game. We are recording this as our peek behind the curtain on July 15th. This will probably come out the second week of August. So whatever that date happens to be, I don't have the calendar in front of me.
Hello, future people.
Yeah. Hello from 2 weeks in the past.
Hey, that could be a whole new world. Don't joke. You have no idea.
That's very true. If the world is still spinning in 3 weeks, hello from 3 weeks in the past.
Yeah.
But I was supposed to be on a research trip, and I was going to hit 4 archives and spend a week in each one in 2 different states. And that hasn't officially been canceled yet, but, you know, I just don't see how it's going to happen at all. Because, as far as I know, the university hasn't reopened funding for university travel, and I sure as hell can't afford to do it on my own. And B, I don't know that the archives where I was going are even open. And I have to give my university credit, my institution credit, my department, I mean, because they did, normally they would give a very, a sizable travel grant to PhD students when it was figured out that travel was not really going to be a thing. They re-engineered it and they're like, hey, if you're a PhD student and you can do digital work on your dissertation through archives or what have you, you can apply, and we've chunked this down to where we can give more people more money, and we'll give you a part of what it would have been to
that's great.
Travel. Yeah, no, it was. It was super awesome. I highly commend the history department for doing that and working with the university to do so. Unfortunately, I'm not in a place. Nothing that I'm looking for is digital.
Yeah.
So, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I've said this on Twitter, but I've been working with a few colleagues of mine as well as a couple of grad students to put together what we plan to be a small symposium on the memory of genocide at Caen. And this is real, like, we still haven't gotten the nuts and bolts in, so this is by no means an announcement. But, and we just, I talked to them Monday, and I said, look, I mean, this is something we talked about behind the scenes, and, like, let's push it back to fall 2021. It was originally going to be, like, April 2020, and we're like, we have no idea what the spring looks like. We have no idea of, like, the rebuilding of society that will occur, hopefully, in the spring. So let's just say, you know, give it another summer.
Yeah.
Like, we have no other option. So.
Well, we'll have to talk about that off air. I don't know if there's anything that I can do to help with that project, but I would love to be involved in some way.
I would.
Even if it's just on the technical side, if you guys decide to do some digital stuff.
That would be amazing. Yeah, we'll talk about it off air. But, yeah, so there, I'm sure that's one of 1,000 probably more than that, considering, you know, the amount of, you know, American and global academics. Like, I can't imagine how many projects, books, articles, dissertation topics or whatever have been completely scrambled around or completely lost because of all this sudden shutdown and the sort of grind to a halt that everything was. And it's like,
unfortunately, it's not going to get better anytime soon.
Oh.
For us, anyway. Now, some of my colleagues in other places, yes, and by other places, I mean other countries, it's going to get better because, again, they have competent leadership and have managed to keep the numbers down and are staging reopening. And it's fit and starts, but it's not the raging pandemic that it is here. I mean, we're one of... I just saw today that we are one of 5 super spreader nations, and it's like us, South Africa, India, Brazil, and Mexico, I think. Yeah. And Mexico probably is because it's close to us.
Yeah.
To be honest.
I mean, Ben, but at least Goya is doing well.
Right. In 75 years, somebody's going to have an awesome paper on the confluence of white nationalism and Goya at this moment. But
I haven't read them, but I know they exist. There's books on the banana industry and how it intersects. I think it's Dole specifically, and how it intersects with like the history of imperialism in Latin America. There is going to be a Goya book.
Yeah, no, there will. Actually, there are two really good books. It's not necessarily on that, but it's on U.S. interventionism and kind of the new filibustering, not like getting before a group of people and talking all the time, but like filibustering as it was in the 19th century. You think William Walker, Banana Men and Banana Wars, that talk about how U.S. capitalist interests, such as the Dole Company, funded private armies to go into Latin America and take over these agricultural fields, sometimes at the behest of the power that be in the country, but oftentimes not so much.
I think Banana Wars has actually been on like a reading list of mine for like years, and it just like, because I have this, you know, everyone has this massive list of one of my favorite courses in grad school, and the one that when I got my master's degree, you know, it was on Latin American genocide. And then you start like looking into like, that is just like, because people don't, and then we could talk about this a bit more if we talk about the monuments. But one of the things that I think Americans don't realize is the settler colonial stuff that occurred across this entire nation obviously occurred in every other location in North and South America. So you have, I guess you can call it like, parallel histories and very similar histories. It's just not as complex because you have, you know, of course, you're not devouring 500 nations. You're devouring one or two indigenous nations, that is, obviously. So, you know, but it's this whole thing. And you're just like, so when you're in my sort of wheelhouse, you're like, I should really know more about Paraguay. But you also look over your shoulder and realize, I don't even know that much about the specifics of Alaska or, you know. So, like, maybe, you know, it's rough. If only I was a Paraguayan genocide scholar, my life would maybe be a little bit easier.
I mean, maybe. I don't know. I guess it depends on when you were doing it. If you're doing it now, maybe it would be okay. But if you were doing it in the 80s, probably not so much.
Oh, no, probably no. No, we are. I will say this right now. If I could not be a historian pre-internet, I will put that sort of millennial, you know, 28-year-old privilege right on the table and say, if you said I have to, no, I would not be able to do it. I literally do not have, you know, I don't have it.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to make one comment on that. I mean, we kind of touched about it when I had you on the show before, but you're right, it is parallel histories. And part of the reason that I think it's kind of occluded is because it's so wrapped up into the lies that we tell ourselves about the founding of our countries. Mm. Because I'm sure that there are a lot of Canadian citizens who, whatever the Canadian equivalent of Manifest Destiny is, and don't really know about just the incredibly harsh and, let's just say it, genocidal treatment towards First Nations peoples in Canada, just like most Americans don't acknowledge what happened here during Manifest Destiny.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's, I mean, what is this? This is, I feel like this is a bit from a comedian or something like that, but Canada is not a post-racial paradise.
No.
It's not a utopia. It's not Michael Moore's utopia. I'm pretty sure that's a bit that I might have stolen from somebody. But, like, it's not this perfect place. It's like, okay, it has, you know, maybe, you know, healthcare and all this stuff, but then if you're, you know, you're also dealing with the same settler colonial issues. You're dealing with the same aftermath of the settler colonial issues. There has been the same kind of forced / coerced sterilization of First Nation people in Canada as there was in the United States.
Yeah.
So, like, it's overly simplistic to say it's the same history, but in a lot of ways it is.
Well, no, that's why I think that term that you use, the parallel history, is so powerful, because it is parallel. It's not exactly the same. And you can say the same thing about Latin America. Although that didn't happen at the same time. I mean, a lot of the conquest of indigenous peoples happened centuries before it did in North America. Yeah. But it's still a genocidal effort being waged against indigenous peoples.
Yeah, and it's not over. Like, you can make an argument. I know of indigenous people that would make an argument that that genocide against Native Americans in the United States isn't over. And I, but that's in Brazil. It's ongoing.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I will say unequivocally that the Bolsonaro administration is a genocidal administration. They have the goal of either, I don't want to direct quote the guy because I can't think of any. The one thing I didn't write down on the 10 pages of notes sitting around me, but, you know, the idea of sending in these missionaries to uncontacted or you know, part, because uncontacted can technically include contacted people that want to be left alone.
Yeah.
And bringing in missionaries by helicopter and, you know, then you have, and that was pre-COVID, it was a disease problem. And you have COVID, and then you have the idea of destroying their culture and destroying their religion on top of, you know, loggers and miners and ranchers. And as well as, you know, let's give credit where credit's due, the drug smuggling in the country, using the rainforest and destroying the rainforest. And, you know, it's, that's ongoing. That's right now.
Yeah, and exactly. And it doesn't have to be a top-down Hitler-esque decision that the entire state leverages all their resources into extermination of a people for it to be genocide.
Yeah.
It can be genocide without being that extreme.
I used this example years ago, and it comes up every once in a while, but they might have passed away, 'cause this is a couple of years ago, but I know in the Amazon there's two, I believe they're elderly individuals, or maybe, who are the last two speakers of their language, the last representation of their people. If you're a logger or a rancher or a drug smuggler, if you shoot one of them, I would consider that a crime of genocide. Because you've annihilated, and that, now, I mean, this is, I mean, you could argue that that's a extreme, but well, when you're dealing with two people, that's 50% of a nation, that's 50% of a people. And, you know, I mean, I think, no, and it's that, that's how I think sometimes. When you get into the subject, you're looking at like, well, what defines a people? Well, if you're the last of your language group, if you're the only two speakers in the world, there you go.
Yeah, without a doubt. And that kind of points to some other stuff that we're working on that we are not ready to talk about at this point. So,
spoilers.
Spoiler alerts. That's what we call TV, ladies and gentlemen. But you had mentioned statues, so let's transfer over to that conversation. And
so,
I have to say, before we get into it, that I am very disappointed in the town in which my alma mater, Murray State University, is located, Murray, Kentucky. The local board, fiscal court, just came down today. I think I had that right, that it was the fiscal court. I could look it up, but I'm too lazy. Just came down today and voted unanimously not to remove the Confederate statue that is in the town square.
There really is, obviously no excuse for keeping any of them. I mean, there is no argument. Because all you have to say, I mean, the basic argument is, you know, betrayed their country to fight a white supremacist war to maintain slavery. There you go. Like, is that what you want to honor? And the answer should be no. But apparently this is lost on far too many cities and states and municipalities.
Yeah, it is. It is. And it's, yeah, it was the Callaway County Fiscal Court, so the county fiscal court that decided to keep the statue. And that's not what we want to talk about, because me and you are on exactly the same page on the Confederate statues. And I mean, I think that, and despite the colossal failures of the Callaway County Fiscal Court, I think that's a pretty low bar when you say, hey, these guys were traitors to their country, they killed Americans, and also fought to perpetuate slavery. That should be controversial.
Yeah, I mean, I will say this. This is a process that will be continuing for some time. Like, when the official sort of, when the book closes and what is officially considered a continuation of the George Floyd, you know, June 2020 protests. It will be a process that will be continually moving forward across the country and hopefully continuously around the world. But as we start to talk about this, I mean, we have to think of the sheer amount of victories that have been achieved. Monument Avenue in Richmond has two statues left. Unfortunately, one of them is Robert E. Lee, but still, it's been disemboweled as far as a sort of shrine to lost cause is concerned.
Yes, you're right. I mean, it is easy to look at these galling setbacks, but there have been a lot of victories.
Yeah.
And because not only that, but I mean the removal of the stars and bars from Mississippi's state flag, the jettisoning or retirement, as they say, of the mascot name of the Washington professional football team. So yeah, there has been a fucking NASCAR banning Confederate flags, which I never thought would happen.
I will plug this. I wrote a piece that it took a month to kind of go through editorial, but I wrote a piece for the online magazine Tropics of Meta, which looked at the George Floyd situation and how that sort of has embraced the sort of transitional justice wave that's sort of been hitting all these different areas, like it's hit the Army and the Navy and the Air Force and Aunt Jemima and, you know, the football and NASCAR and statues. You know, like, if you told me 2 years ago that there was going to be a popular movement globally that would take out Aunt Jemima and King Leopold II, I would think you were joking.
Right.
For those of you who may not know, King Leopold II committed the Belgian rubber terror in the Congo during the scramble for Africa. So, in case that was a bit of an obscure, I don't know. I would give the audience of Evoking History the benefit of the doubt, but just in case.
Yeah, I would like to think that the majority of my listeners know what that is, but there are always some who don't. And if you're looking for something really accessible to read on that, get King Leopold's Ghost.
Mm-hmm.
That
Absolutely.
Is a very well-written, very easy read that is also devastating because, well, I mean, there's a reason we're talking about him in the way that we are.
Yeah, there's debate over whether or not it's a genocide, but I am firmly in the camp that it's a genocide. You can't mutilate black Africans for not producing enough rubber when there isn't enough rubber to maintain that quota, and then say, oh no, it's not an attempt to destroy the Congolese people. No, not at all.
Well, and then also lead to their numbers dropping by as much as half and 10 million people dying.
Yeah.
Not that it's always a numbers game, and because I don't want to get caught up in that, because I think that genocide can happen on a much smaller scale if you look at per capita populations or anything like that. I resist the need to rank atrocities by the number of people killed. But, you know, by any measure that you want to use, what happened in the Belgian Congo is unconscionable.
I avoid, you know, whatever you want to call it. You want to call it the genocide Olympics. You want to call it the numbers game. Whatever you want to call it. I just sort of, like, look at the intent. Look at the plan. Look at the primary sources. Look at the history. Don't count up bodies. That's unproductive. Right. That's how you get to statements like, well, you know, the atomic bombings were genocidal. Well, no, they were not. But anyway, and it's that's not...
You can. But, I would make the case that they're war crimes, but
that's something. Oh, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. I'm not saying, you know, I am no way saying that is an area of history where we are innocent and that there is no moral or ethical question to be asked. But let's just say the people that there's a lot of bad arguments in both sides of that issue. Life.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Let's sort of go back to monuments.
Yes, because we kind of got sidetracked. Because what I wanted to talk about is there's this constant noise coming from the right about, well, where this is all a slippery slope and where does it stop? What about, you know, oh, somebody threw paint on a statue of Grant. Somebody pulled down a statue of Grant or other Union general here. or the whole Columbus stuff. So let's dissect that a little bit.
Okay. Well, one, I will take the bold position of saying Hans Christian Hegg gets to keep his damn statue. I'll take that bold position. But to answer the question seriously, I don't know where it ends, but here's the thing. I do think we're at sort of a starting point. Confederates, obviously. I mean, there's really, as I just kind of might have said this like 5 minutes ago, there's no clearer line for who does not get a statue in a country than people who betrayed the country and shot at its own soldiers. You know, especially, let's put this, you know, you'll say, oh, well, you know, the war ended and they became Americans again. Like, yeah, but the guys who died didn't. Stonewall Jackson didn't die an American. Stonewall Jackson died a Confederate. Like, we could, you know, if we're gonna, you know, split hairs on that, but, you know, let's be precise.
Right. Well, especially Nathaniel Bedford Forrest. Fuck that guy. Because not only was he a Confederate general who committed an atrocity during the War of the Fort Pillow Massacre, but then he goes on to find the first Ku Klux Klan, which is still not considered a terrorist group for some reason, but is a role model for all kinds of virulent paramilitaries throughout the world that are enforcing racial hierarchies through terrorism.
Yeah. Like, it's maddening. If we change Fort Bragg or any of them, you know, then they will disrespect. Like, really? I think I made a tweet about this, but I'll say it again because I think it's one of my better jokes. It's like, unless the ghosts of Confederate generals rose up from those forts through representational magic and fought in the Second World War, they didn't help win the war.
Yeah,
and even then, they don't deserve a damn fort named after them.
No, not at all. There are so many names that could be put on forts. That's actually something that the current occupant of the White House has really dug in his heels and has quit dog whistling to white nationalists and white supremacists and started foghorning them. So that won't change for as long as him and his family are in the office, which I'm hoping will end in November, but I'm not convinced that it will.
I want to be very clear about something. And again, I'm pretty sure your audience understands this entirely, but in case anyone else stumbles upon this episode, it's all culture war bullshit. I'm sorry, am I allowed to curse on here? Well, it's too late.
Yeah.
In February of 2019, a California town removed the president of McKinley. Removed a statue of President McKinley. And no fanfare, no, you know, they're going after our heroes, they're going after our history. I pulled up the tweet from probably August of 2015 from the current president of the United States, who was blaring about, you know, Obama changing the name of the mountain back to Denali and saying, oh, I will change it back. But he hasn't, obviously. Anyone, again, in case someone, this is probably preaching to the choir to like a 10th degree, but in case anyone else hears this, the man doesn't care about anything that is actually going on. He cares about riding a wave for his own benefit. So this entire conversation, how this conversation has been set up nationally, is built literally on AstroTurf. You know, it's only... But it's moving away from that. I think the Confederates are easy. And I think, in my opinion, so is the statue to those that murdered indigenous people. But I looked this up monument-wise as I was preparing to come on. And, of course, there's loads of Columbus statues that have come down one way or another, which I applaud with every bit of, you know, vigor that I can. But what I notice is they're mostly Spanish. They're mostly Spanish conquistadors. The guys that the gentleman who's why did I call him a general? The monster. The person who is perpetrated the Acoma massacre. The person that was responsible for the colonization of California. The man who settled suppress the Pueblo Revolt. These are all, again, Spanish, and you have, and then there's a few exceptions, like the two Kit Carson statues, I think, came down, and then, of course, Jackson, Mississippi removed their statue of the former president, and I think John Mason was removed in Connecticut, and he's the person, one of the leading figures in what is commonly referred to as the Pequot War, but I call it the Pequot Genocide, in my opinion. So we're slowly but certain. Oh, and they also removed, I'm sorry, I'm scribbling through notes here. They also removed John Sutter had a statue removed in Sacramento, and I believe a town in Alaska very recently, or maybe earlier in June, removed a statue of one of the lead managing figures of Russian colonization in Alaska. So we're in the indigenous realm, we're making progress, but we seem to be hitting mostly the easier non-American figures that, I mean, also, I'll be honest, if you told me Mississippi would be the first town that I'm aware of to remove a statue of Andrew Jackson, I'd be like, hmm. But it's, oh, and then I think in Alaska, they decided, in Alaska, I think the mayor of Anchorage said that they would consider removing their captain of, again, the statue of Captain James Cook. But they wanted a local indigenous group to make that decision. But of course, Cook Inlet in Alaska gets to stay, which
right.
sort of what I've been moving towards in this sort of rambling diatribe about statues and names is, I mean, it's always menacing, I think, especially to people on a certain side of the political spectrum that say statues are the beginning. But, you know, they kind of are.
should be.
Yeah. I think, you know, for example, you know, if a location has an indigenous name, I mean, I'm not talking about like cities are a bit more complicated than the door, but if you're talking about like geographical locations, mountains, especially mountains, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Go by, name them that, or at least have, let it go by two names on, you know, plaques and whatnot. It's a simple thing, you know, yeah. For the most part, it's giving away nothing.
Exactly.
you know, and then you get into the really, really rough territory, which, you know, when you get to stuff like, what are we going to do about the Black Hills? Well, the moral and legal answer is, Black Hills ain't ours. So, actually, that was a whole bunch of rambling. Anyway,
it was not as rambling as you may think it was. And I agree with you on almost everything you said. But I do want to give some credence, because even though a lot of the statues that you mentioned that have been taken down of conquistadors and things of that nature, those didn't come down without activism from the Latinx communities of those areas, or the native communities of those areas. And there was a lot of white nationalists surrounding them too, even though those are Spanish and have nothing to do with our country. It's what they represent and symbolize.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is getting back to what I was sort of saying about the sort of transitional wave that sort of spun out of all this is, you know, it's sort of lighting a fire under largely local issues that have been simmering for years, if not decades.
Yeah.
Like, I am a New Yorker. I live in New York City. I live on Staten Island, but I'm part of the city. Everybody, you know. I, as a New Yorker who studied the imperial history of this nation, did not know until it came up in news articles about the statue at the of Theodore Roosevelt outside of the public library. I didn't know. Oh, not the Museum of Natural History. I didn't know there was particularly indigenous controversy trying to get that dealt with for decades. I didn't know. So I'm an individual in that sort of space, in that, you know, educated space as a scholar and as, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I didn't know about that. And that sort of bothers me, because now I'm just like, how much don't I actually know about these issues until they're blown up, you know, to the highest possible volume?
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's the thing. That's the moment that we have, and I hope it's not squandered, because we've had similar moments where, and I'm about, oh, I don't know, 13, 14 years older than you, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And not that that makes me, you know, super wise or anything, because I'm not, but I have seen other moments in the past where we have had these moments where we could have had awakening. We could have, you know, to get biblical, washed the scales from our eyes and looked at things clearly and confronted our past honestly and tried to make amends. Whatever that is, whether that is taking down some statues, which, you know, call me a radical leftist all you want, but I'm cool with taking down all the statues because they're just fucking statues. You can put them in museums. You know, countries and empires, which is what we are. We're an empire. We're not just a country. Cities, people change statues. They change the names of things. It's really not that big a deal. You can have an honest conversation about these things and address some of the hurt and pain in this nation, at, like you said, at a really low cost, if you are willing to do it. But, you know, we have, as yet, except for in a few instances, and more instances than in the past, as you have rightly pointed out, we have not really been willing to do to try and rectify some of these systemic issues that have been with us since the founding. And yes, I say founding for a reason, because I do include our founding fathers.
Yeah.
Washington, Jefferson, and all of them were slave owners.
Mm-hmm.
They wrote words that are great, that resonate through the ages, that they didn't truly believe because they did not apply them. So, and you can still valorize Washington for all his victories and the thing that he was our first president, father of the nation, all that. But you also have to address the bad.
Yeah, and you could look at, you know, Jefferson and say he was a great scholar and a great literary, but you also have to bring up, like, yeah, he also raped underage slaves, so let's not do this.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but of course, you get, like, this is the problem, is, and I kind of alluded to this earlier when we were talking about something else. I said, the conversation that we should be having and the conversation that we're having are not the same.
Right.
The conversation we should be having is, how do we take problematic individuals and figure out how we move forward with their legacies and with their memory and et cetera, in the public space in a way that is both historically accurate and does not shy away from, let's rephrase that, because you can't go into a first grade classroom and say, hey, guess what Jefferson did? But in talking about a public space, say, and not ignore, let's use that language, not ignore the sides of them that get lost in, let's call it the, you know, the founding cause. Let's call it that.
Yeah.
The stuff that gets sort of, you know, washed away amid, you know, all the other sort of fanfare. Is, you know, you remember that, you know, the Declaration of Independence refers to indigenous people en masse as savages who do not understand or care about the laws of war. I'm paraphrasing, I'm sure. And directly links them in that document, a declaration of war, to be enemies of the state.
Yeah.
Now, I don't want to put that document through a shredder. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to white out that section of the document. I don't want to, you know, quote unquote, cancel the document. But I want, if it's taught, to say, hey, this is also a document that we also recognize as problematic and no longer represents the totality of what makes the United States the United States. You know, it was, I mean, it's why in, you know, my last probably 10 years or so, I transitioned away from referring to Jefferson as my favorite founder to Benjamin Franklin. It's one of the reasons, because I can't think of a founder aside from Franklin who looked at an indigenous massacre in Pennsylvania and it's had outrage, thought it was a completely barbaric, as opposed to, other founders and some people that would come after the founder, particularly Jackson and others, who would partake at the federal level using military force, those same kind of atrocities. It's, oh, right, again, another tangent. But what I'm saying is that that's the conversation we should be having. How do we figure that out? The conversation we're having is, are statues bad? That's right. Not the same conversation.
Yeah.
And that's why in a lot of these areas, like I would guess the county of your alma mater is probably one of them, and others. That's why, you know, the side of historical literacy loses, because we're, I shouldn't generalize, but I'm saying largely, at least in sort of the halls of academia, I can't say necessarily on the protest level, but out, you know, in the halls of op-eds and televised statements and, you know, whatnot, our Twitter conversation, we're talking about, how do we address these people? How do we address what they did? How do we look at it? That's not what the other side cares about. The other side is building this up as a destruction of history, as a, you know, I haven't literally seen this, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's some terrible take describing it similar to book burning. Like, there's, actually, I might have seen a take like that, actually. Like, it's two different, completely alien conversations. And that's why, like, they say, oh, well, why is, you know, and we have a lot of wins. I mean, honestly, I think that out of all the wins, like, even if I take away all the statues, the fact that we have the U.S. military after hundreds, you know, or the 165 years, more than that, probably. I'm terrible at math. To say, oh yeah, we're not going to allow you guys to bring the banners of traitors onto the base.
Yeah.
Well, it took you guys that long.
Well, and you know, in testimony, I think it was last week, one of the Joint Chiefs of Staff went before the Congress and said, hey, look, you know, these guys were traitors. They committed an act of treason, and our military is 30-something percent people of color. If they have to go serve one of these bases, they might be serving on a base that's named after somebody who, in the case of the African-American troops, that held one of their ancestors as a slave.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of other people deserving who weren't traitors to their country to have these bases named after.
I mean, it seems like common sense.
It does.
But common sense sort of dies at the border to the nation of the lost cause. It's just sort of like, oh, along with like reason and logic and historical literacy. But like,
yeah.
It's the same thing with Holocaust denial. It's the same thing with, you know, the nationalism that goes against, you know, trying to recognize indigenous people. It's the same thing with, you know, Japanese imperial nationalists and, you know, Serbs that deny the you know, the genocide in the Balkans. And it's just all over the place. And, you know.
Go ahead.
I know. I'm saying it's the same thing that has just, I don't think there's a massive denialist conspiracy, but it's the sort of same behavior sort of given a, you know, draped in a different flag. It's the same ideology.
Well, and a lot of it is wrapped up in the fears of demographic change, and I think subconsciously a fear that once you are no longer the majority in the country, that you will be treated by the new majority the way you treated minorities in the past.
Yeah. There's a name for that. Oh, why can't I think of it? There's a name for that. It's called it's mirror something. It's a basic, you know. I'm sure you and I have both seen it. We're thinking of the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Of the idea of, you know, the sort of projecting.
Yeah.
The sort of genocidary predict projecting upon, like, if we don't kill them all, they'll kill all of us. And we go, well, we better kill them all.
Yeah.
I mean. Because, really, a side bit, really quick, while we're on that. This is why I don't like when people refer to Hitler or others who are responsible for genocide as insane or crazy. I don't like it, and it's not true, because I hate to say it, and this might be a bit controversial as a statement. Genocide on a certain level follows a logic. because they've tapped into that exact sort of rhetoric, that exact sort of fear, and use it that. So it's sort of like really, I hate, like, oh, Hitler was a madman. I'm like, no, because now you're just, also that's problematic for, you know, issues of, you know, demonizing people with mental illness. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's anyway.
Well, it's, and I agree with you, it's a twisted logic, but you, if you accept the worldview, if you accept the ideologic base that they're operating out of, then it, you follow that to a logical conclusion.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that logical conclusion is genocide. And it doesn't have to be, as it has proven time and time and time again, the ideology does not have to be as warped and perverted as Nazism is, or National Socialism. But if you buy in, and that's why this is kind of a scary moment, because we have seen so many of our fellow countrymen, and not for the first time either, who have bought into a certain worldview, into a certain ideological stance, and they do see this. They do see this not as we are attempting to correct the misgivings of history by holding these statues and the people they represent accountable for the misdeeds they did. They see it as an actual attack against them and their quote-unquote culture, or them and their belief systems, because the right does a masterful job of tying all this into Christianity, because Christianity has, on certain, in this country especially, been a handmaiden to white nationalism and white supremacy. So they see that as a attack against the their core beliefs. And if you attack somebody's core beliefs, they are often going to react in an incredibly violent manner.
Yeah. It's yeah, exactly. It's disturbing. People have literally died because of the behavior to protect shrine to dead traitors. I mean, there's obviously, and of course, I'm unfortunately blanking on a name, but there's the young woman who was murdered during the so-called Unite the Right rally.
Oh, yeah.
And there's been other cases where people have either been shot or hit by cars during the protests, but also during incidents entirely surrounding statues. And I'm like, I cannot imagine being a family member to one of these individuals that has been killed, and sort of going through in your head that, you know, my child or my nephew or whatever, my brother or sister or et cetera, was murdered by somebody who thought that a bronze statue to a traitor was more valuable than a human life.
Yeah. It was Heather Heyer who was...
Right, I'm sorry. Body, so,
no reason to be sorry. I mean, you can't remember everything. I know I certainly can't. But yes, and I think that Charlottesville is a good case because... the chant, "You will not replace us." And I think that, to me, underlies the fear. Maybe I'm being too simplistic about it. Maybe my own studies of the extreme right are playing into my reading of things. But that, I really do see this as a regime, and I'm not talking about the current administration overtly here, but they are part of it. But we really do see that there is a certain section of the country who holds these beliefs, who do not consider themselves racist. They consider themselves to be honest and true Americans. And they see this as an attacking of everything that they love about America, but all the stuff that they love about America that they have accepted uncritically.
Yeah.
And as that group, which is still quite large, maybe even approaching, I don't know what's approaching majority, but it's still roughly 30-30% of the nation, give or take.
I'd accept that number.
Yeah. As we see that, them beginning to feel that they are losing power, they are going to grip on tightly. And I think you're right, we have to acknowledge the victories that we've had in these fights. And I do think that in the long run, that we will come out of this and with the acknowledgments, and whether it's we put up two plaques, this person did this good thing, but they also did this bad thing. There you go. You have all the information there. This is now a learning space. We're just what they claim the statues are, whatever.
Yeah.
But I also, thinking back, again, this is where me being older than you, having lived through some of these moments, I never thought, two things that have happened in my life that amazed me was the wall coming down in East Berlin without a fight and the apartheid regime falling without a war, without mass violence. Not that there wasn't some violence, but it wasn't related to the regime change. And I'm afraid, even though we are not a full-on apartheid nation in the same way, we are heavily segregated, we are heavily divided amongst racial and class lines, and as this group that has aligned itself or is being used by political elites and some corporate elites, as the reins of power they feel slipping from their hands, I do think that we are going to have mass incidences of violence, or that we could have mass incidences of violence beyond the 60-something incidences of vehicles surrounding protesters that we've seen since the George Floyd protests began, beyond stuff like Unite the Right that happened before this. We have all kinds of reports of not only police brutality against protesters, but I saw a news story today, and I don't know when it happened, but it had to happen within the last few days, of a guy in a Walmart pulling a gun on somebody who came up to him and mentioned something to him about wearing a mask. Anyway, those are my fears. So I kind of went off on the rant there.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I looked something up real quick to make sure I would be right about the date. But when you were talking about Charlottesville, they were also chanting blood and soil.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And when I heard, I will say that I believe it's a 20-something minute Vice documentary that came out right in the aftermath of that with the, they had them in their own words, and they were interviewing the actual, you know, in lack of a better word, and not to make light of the situation, the rogues gallery that is the alt-right. You know, that was one of the most horrifying short pieces I've seen. And I'm, you know, and I've seen, you know, Rwanda tapes and, you know, stuff like that. You know, I've seen terrible things, and just to see that this is America. You know, and you say, well, that's their right. And I'm like, yeah, it is, but that doesn't make it less horrifying. But Blood and Soil is the title of Benjamin Kiernan's book on global genocide that was published in 2007. So, like, that's not subtlety.
No.
That they're not, like, they're declaring who the literal soil is for, who the literal land is for. And you don't get any more colonial than that. You don't get any more imperialist than that.
No, not at all. You mentioned Bosnia earlier, and I want to spend a few moments as we come up on the hour talking about that, because as we record this, like I said, it's July 15th. Well, on the 11th of July, so 4 days ago, it was the 20th anniversary, or excuse me, the 25-year anniversary of the Srebrenica genocide, in which 8,000 Bosnian Muslims were killed. And it's funny to me, that's probably a bad term, but in looking back on it, as somebody who was alive during the time, you have this going on, and then Rwanda happens. So you have two incredibly intense genocides that get all kinds of national and international attention within a very short period of time. As a genocide scholar, I wanted to, and I know that you mainly do the Americas, but if you had any thoughts on the Bosnian genocides.
I will say up front that the Bosnian genocide is actually probably my weakest modern area. And I will say up front, I have no idea why. I have read, watched, researched, sat through long lectures, sat through multiple versions of the same lecture on the whole, the intricacies of the before, during, and after. And for some reason, it never, the details themselves, I don't want to say go in one ear and out the other because it's not entirely accurate, but it's never, I hope you understand what I'm trying to say, but I do know, well, one, it's a genocide. It's and some people sort of part heirs and put Srebrenica as its own genocide, and I don't think you could do that because I think there was far more. I think that sort of gives sort of Serbian nationalism an out for everything else that was going on. But you're talking about a city under an entire city under siege. You're talking about I know one. Detail that did always stick with me is there were Serbian military snipers up on the tall buildings of the city. I don't want to call them skyscrapers because I don't think that's what they are, but the tall buildings of the city, looking down and just randomly just shooting at pedestrians and passersby. You're talking about, no, like, to call it a massacre almost doesn't do it justice. It's the enforcement of a terror state over a city for days at a time. And when I hear people, because again, there's always denialists. I said this before, it's the same ideology wearing a different color hat or draped in a different flag. But when I hear people like Noam Chomsky, who, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of anyway, but to say that it doesn't fit the term genocide, that I'm a bit paraphrasing, but I can also swear he's on record for saying that it devalues the term or some synonym like that. I'm like, are you out of your mind? Like, if, you know, randomly shooting people in the streets of a city because you either know or presume they're Bosniak Muslims isn't genocidal, you shouldn't be allowed to talk about anything in the public space, let alone that. If you can't put that together, it's terrifying that people think that way, and it's problematic, one, because it's genocide denial, and two, because we're getting to a point, once again in Europe, if we haven't already gotten there, if we haven't already reached the tipping point, I hope we haven't, where... not necessarily Bosniaks again, although unfortunately you never know. But once again, you've created this other out of people who are Muslim, different denominations, where you have areas of Europe, particularly Eastern Europe, where they say things, you know, again, I'm paraphrasing, about them being, you know, devaluing the culture. You know, Hungary is a big example of it. And you're always wondering, I'm like, when is this going to tip over? Are we going to look at another genocide of people in Europe because of their faith? And I know that's not the best take to come out of the remembrance, which is already a terrible anniversary of pain and memory. But I can't help but, you know, see it in that direction. I'm thinking, looking like, will it be Hungary this time? Will it be, you know? And I know that's probably not what you were expecting.
No, but I think that's all valid because you do see a lot of these tensions, and a lot of them, unfortunately, are in ties with immigration crises, and then there's all this Islamophobia. And all these other things, and we don't have to get into it because I think we're a little bit over an hour already, so I don't want to spend a whole bunch more time on it, though I could talk with you about this forever. Is this the situation in China with the Uyghur Muslims? And I don't think they've started mass killings there. Maybe they have, and I just don't know about it. But a lot of people are dying. A lot of people are being forced sterilization. being forced into these camps, these internment camps, quote unquote, which, you know, a concentration camp by any other name, which I add parenthetically, much like we have all kinds of immigrants on our southern border in, so there's that. So yeah, I do. I think that as we go into a potentially global, terrible economic downturn because of COVID, and we have all these other forces, especially as we are in a authoritarian moment, again, I have fears about another genocide happening.
Yeah, it's
we're continuing, because you could actually make a case that what's going on in China is a genocide.
I can. They're probably a pushback about, oh, you know, the source for the story is he's a far right Christian guy who hates China, which might be true. I don't know. But if the stories coming out of China are true, that Uyghur women are being sterilized and or, it doesn't matter which one, or are going through forced abortions so that they do not give birth to children of their ethnicity, that is genocidal. It's no stop. There's no doubt in my mind. That meets, without a doubt, without question, Raphael Lemkin's layout for what a biological genocide is.
Yeah.
There's no question, to the point where, you know, I don't have the date off the top of my head, but he put in a New York Times op-ed, I think a few years after the book was released in 1944, clarifying, like, yeah, forced sterilization is genocide. So if that's what's going on, that's a genocide, period.
Yeah.
And I, at risk, I know you we're kind of winding down, but the one thing, I've said this a few times to, let's say, more right-wing people that I know and that I've talked to, especially the ones that deny global warming, or I'm sorry, deny climate change, and you'll see why in a second. And I say, Bangladesh is one of the poorest, if not the poorest country on Earth. It's full of, the vast majority of Bangladeshis are brown-skinned Muslims. If you're worried about a massive immigration crisis of Muslim foreigners, you're going to get that when the water levels rise in Bangladesh.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what, there's a terrible part of my mind that, you know, again, like the hunger example, when I'm sitting here going, like, is this inevitable? Am I just sitting here watching, like, the fire sort of cut across the woods, waiting until it hits, you know, whatever structure that I want to not hit? You know, I'm just, sometimes I almost feel like that, like, is this inevitable? And, you know, I hope not. But I, as you could tell, I'm not entirely an optimist. But I'm hoping, I have to try to be hopeful that I'm either misjudging what track we're on, or that there's going to be a shift. I don't know.
Well, call me a pessimist as well, but as you listen to the talk. And I don't want to say nothing is inevitable. Contingency is a very real thing in history. You know, people do not, as an aside, rational actor theory, that people will act rationally. People don't act rationally. That is been proven time and time again. So the whole rational actor theory, what would a rational actor do in given these situations? Because people will actually choose the worst outcome for themselves because of ideological reasons often.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not often, but on enough times for it to be relevant statistically. So, but to your point, and going back to that fire through the woods analogy, I think that we are at a moment where we have been in a drought for a while. There's a lightning storm coming, and there are several places where the fire could start. It doesn't mean it will. And especially if and not to blow our own horn, but people like yourself and myself and our friends in academia, our friends in activism.
Public history museum.
Yeah, yeah. Just everybody. If we keep sounding the alarm and calling attention to these things, perhaps we can, we may not be able to prevent them from happening, but maybe we can put the fire out before it engulfs the entire forest.
I hope so. That's, you know, the end on a slightly higher note, hopefully. Because, you know, talking about genocide is always fun. That's why education is important. And I say this definitively. I can't save the guy in the body armor with the tactical gear waving around the Confederate flag around the Robert E. Lee statue. I can't save him. It's not within my power. And to be honest, it might be a risk to my life to try. I can't. He's gone. But his children, their children, the next generation, the generation after them, they're not lost yet. And I know that sounds like, oh, liberal indoctrination. No, it's not. It's the fact that, you know, I don't try to convince people about my political belief. I try to show them the evidence and say, here, look at the truth. Look at the evidence. Look at this material. And then make a decision. You could like Andrew Jackson. Fine. But I need you to understand and hopefully wrestle with morally the worst aspects about him. You can like the populism. You could like the bringing people into the White House and the, you know, the giant cheese, which off the top of my head, I'm not even sure if that's true. You could like all the fun bits, but you have to take in the Trail of Tears, the mutilating creeks, and you got to bring in all the other stuff. That's all I want. I just want historic literacy. And I want that. That's what I want almost more than anything else. As someone who is beginning or has begun their career as an educator, would like to hopefully, if the whole everything being on fire, and I don't mean that in terms of COVID, you know, cools down, to do this for the rest of my life. But that's all I really want. And I think it's rather small. It's like, let's deal with the things that shouldn't be massive ideological battles. Treatment is bad. Genocide is bad. Like, sorry, you don't get to be objective on those two points. Slavery is bad. Like, you're not allowed to pretend like that I have to be objective on those issues. And I refuse to be that.
I think that's a really good, because I think those are not objective statements either. And I just want to close with a quote from James Baldwin. And because I think that a lot of the listeners will probably agree with this. And I think it's something that our friends on the either side of the political spectrum sometimes forget. But it's, I love America more than any other country in this world. And exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually. Because until we live up to those fine words that are in the Declaration, I believe all men are created equal. Until we actually live up to that, we are a hypocritical country, and we are hypocritical people. And I don't know about you, but I hate being a hypocrite. I thank you, Michael, for taking the time. Please let people know where they can find you and promote. Give them, actually send me the link and I'll put it in the show notes for the article that you wrote that you mentioned. But please pimp anything you got.
Hopefully there will be a link in the description for my recent article connecting how the George Floyd protest has sort of spun out and in court and hit other transitional justice issues in the United States and abroad. And you could find me on Twitter at Deck of Carter, DeckofCarter. It was a bad pun that I thought of when I started the account years ago, and I regret it. But that's my Twitter account, damn it. And as always, I love being here, and thank you for having me.
Well, you're very welcome. I want you to come back on because I know that you have written about forced sterilization in Puerto Rico. So I do want us to have that conversation at some point soon. But for now, this was a good conversation, a bit rambling, but sometimes you just got to get together and clear the air that way. And again, thank you, Michael.
It's, again, an absolute pleasure, and you're absolutely welcome. I'll come on anytime. Whenever you have a blank space in the calendar, please.
Well, I will take you up on that. And thank you for listening to the Evoking History Podcast.